Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is podcast time, and today we are going to celebrate and mark International Women's Day. We're going to talk about the role of course, half the population. It's a kind of a bizarre thing when you actually think about it, that there is a day instituted officially to celebrate and recognize women who are actually half of the population. So we're talking about your sisters, your wives, your cousins, your friends, your girlfriends, the people you hang out with, your mothers, of course, your daughters in John and I's case, your aunties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But nonetheless, we're going to be talking to Alice Evans about a really fascinating female story, a women's story, which is the women's story in East Asia and particularly in China. But first, John, how are you, man?
I'm good. You're off gallivanting, as always. But anyway, but you know, actually, what is interesting and related to what we're going to talk about, I was reading an article in the FT during the week about China. China's not in a great place at the moment, yep, by all accounts. But they're having another one of those kind of mega meetings. You know, those meetings, yes, that they all, it's like a big huddle.
They do huddle.
And all the top Politburo guys are there doing their thing. But the thing is, the Prime Minister, Li Qiang, made a big speech and set out his vision for the future and, you know, the plan for the Chinese lives for the rest, for the next, I don't know, 1,000 years or whatever. But what was interesting about it is, because China's not in a great place at the moment, he identified three main problems that China's facing, that the Chinese economy is facing at the moment. And they include, well, one we've spoken about before is the construction industry, the overcapacity and overbuilding and then overleveraged problems with the construction industry and Evergrande and companies like that. Then there's also local debt, apparently, is a major problem there. And then, of course, there's a lack of domestic demand. People just aren't spending. So the solution that they're introducing over the next while is they've set a target for growth for next year of 5%. But how they're going to get there is they're issuing another trillion renminbi bond and they're going to focus on all these various different areas. But the thing that really struck me and what's related to this, why I'm mentioning it now, is that one of the areas that they're focusing on is a maternity policy. They want to boost fertility, which will have a major impact, not just on the economy for them, but also on food production, the environment and the world in general.
Well, it is.
So it's quite a...
Well, it's a funny thing. I am speaking to you, John, from Italy, right? I'm here, yeah, in Italy. I'm actually doing a little tour. I'm doing a Dante tour tomorrow in Florence. And I'm actually, ooh, doing a Joyce tour in Trieste on the weekend. So I'll be full of classical literary references. But fascinating you talk about that, right?
Excellent.
It was Mussolini here in Italy who first instituted payments for having children, which is exactly what the Chinese are about to do. So if you think the bizarre thing about Chinese demography is the following. The single child policy introduced in the 1970s dramatically changed the complexion of Chinese demography because it forced women to have abortions and only have one child. And that, of course, led to all sorts of things like the killing of young children, female children when they were born, and a bias towards young male children, etc. So a whole load of bizarre things. And I'm going to talk to you about abortion in a second because, interestingly, your friend Donald Trump, who won the Super Tuesdays, is not winning as much as people think. So basically what people are looking at is the difference between the declared people who said they're going to vote for Trump and the outcome. And what there's a real sense is that liberal women from the Republican Party are abandoning Trump. They're not saying it to pollsters, but they're actually doing it in the polls because of his stance on abortion, because of abortion rights in America. We'll talk about that in a second. But abortion in China. So what you had was, of course, a dramatic fall in the population. And this led to the fear in China, John, that China would get old before it got rich, that you had this extraordinary truncation of the population in the 1970s and 1980s, where the fertility rate dropped from about 4 babies per woman, which is very, very high, to obviously a forced one child. Now, this, of course, changed the complexion dramatically. And this is what the Chinese are now trying to reverse, because what they have is they have a population pyramid, which is the thing you see if you look at the way the population tends to grow, which is a huge amount of kids at the bottom and a very few people at the very, very top, almost like a Christmas tree formation, right? That is reversed in China. And now what they're trying to do is they're trying to reverse the whole thing. So they're doing what Mussolini did, John. They're trying to pay Chinese women. Now, they will pay Chinese women to have more babies. And the reason is they're trying to avoid what happened to Japan, where the population has fallen very, very rapidly.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I always found that one-child policy, it never quite sat right with me, because, you know, the Chinese are usually great at looking at the big picture and planning long-term and all the rest. But this was like, this was a huge mistake. And how come they didn't see what was obvious to everybody, that a one-child policy is going to result in this inverted demographic?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's. I think they did see it, but I think their immediate problem was famine. So if you look at what happened in the Cultural Revolution, the Mao Zedong's, one of his many, many bizarre drives to purify the socialist soul of the Chinese was the Cultural Revolution. And of course, the Cultural Revolution led to an extraordinary, extraordinary period of famine in the countryside. So I think what they did was they took a very, very old school view, said, well, look, hold on a second. If we have too many people and not enough food, what can we cut first? Can we boost food production? Well, maybe not. So what we'll do is we'll cut population, which again is dramatic. But it's an interesting framework for this discussion. And what is interesting, John, is the notion of what's happening in the United States with Donald Trump, right? That basically white liberal Republican women are abandoning him. And this, of course, is a story that has been untold in the latest hoo-ha about him winning the Super Tuesdays. The latest story is that in the past, they used to talk about the secret Trump voter who didn't admit voting for Trump, but then went into the ballot box and did. Now what you have is the ghost Trump voter, the person who claims they're going to vote for Trump, but actually goes into the ballot box and isn't doing so. And basically you see the difference between stated intentions in the polls and the outcomes in all these primaries. But that's another issue we will discuss. But now, John, on International Women's Day, let us go and talk to Alice Evans, who is an amazing sociologist. She's an economist. She looks at the world. She looks at cultural changes. She does amazing field research. And let's go and talk to Alice about what she discovered about China, about money, about materialism, and about the participation of women in the Chinese workforce and the participation of women in Chinese and Korean culture in general. It is fascinating stuff. So let's go talk to Alice. I have on the line an exceptionally interesting person who goes by the name Empress, Her Royal Divinity, Her Extraordinary Highness, Her Intellectual Savviness, unbelievable. Her real name is Alice Evans, but on the basis that she's also another Redzer, and we've just had an off chat Redzerfest about the trauma of our youth, and I was exchanging stories with her, which I may well keep to myself because they're a little bit inappropriate for this hour of the day. And this is a podcast for the whole family. So Her Royal Highness Alice Evans, sociological researcher par extraordinaire, is on the line from New York, but that is only half of the story. She spends her time traveling around the world trying to assess, it's a really fascinating, fascinating piece of work and research, you know, what makes cultures different, what makes societies different, what makes us different, how do we put the whole thing together, how do we explain the big world and join all the dots. So, Your Royal Highness, I see you're in very, very palatial New York-type surroundings there. How are you?
Everything is wonderful, thank you.
Now, Alice, explain to me, you are just back from China.
Yes.
You are just back from that part of Asia, China, Korea. You wrote a very interesting Substack. And I want to talk about the role of women, and I want to talk around the role of cultural change in China and Asia. But you wrote a very interesting Substack about the role of money in Asia and something that you picked up straight away. Explain to me what you saw on your travels, because I love the way you do your research. I'm in a supermarket. I'm talking to this old lady. I'm talking to these young girls. I'm talking to these old guys. So explain to me your method, what you found in China, and the love of money and materialism that you saw in that part of Asia.
Right, David. So I am writing a book called The Great Gender Divergence, which is about how the entire world has become more gender equal, but some regions are far more gender equal than others. And one of the most fascinating stories, perhaps the biggest conundrum in human history that we haven't yet answered, is why some countries are far more gender equal than others. So in East Asia, about 150 years ago, it was extremely patriarchal. Girls were socialized to marry, stay put, please their in-laws. There was a lot of foot binding. Women had very little status or autonomy. But over the 20th century, we've seen soaring female employment. And as women go to cities, they mix and mingle. They bitch and moan and complain about the patriarchy. They lambast patriarchal traditions and they push for change. So now East Asians in general have very high rates of female labor force participation, far stronger support for gender equality and growing feminist activism or online especially. So why has this happened? Whereas in the Middle East, North Africa and South Asia, female employment is very low. Many people idealize ideas of, you know, female seclusion and obedience. So what I do, exactly as you say, I go off to Hong Kong, I stay in the Chinese University of Hong Kong, I interview lots of students coming over from China, I potter around, and I also go to Korea. So let me tell you, so I do a lot of pottering. You know, I chat to people and I potter. So I pop into this antique shop because I'm very interested in material culture. And I notice all these very beautiful coasters and I ask him to tell me about it. And among things, he says, well, this is the fish. And the fish, the carp, symbolizes abundance, wealth, and prosperity. And here's another symbol, he tells me, and it symbolizes promotion. And that's really important. I thought, oh, that's interesting. He tells me more and we discover a mutual connection. So I buy all these little pretty coasters and I go off to my interview with this elderly Cantonese woman. And as a way of introducing myself and breaking the ice, I show her the coasters all about prosperity and wealth. And she said, oh, yes, that's very, very important. And she tells me about all these Lunar New Year traditions, which are all about wealth and prosperity. I also noticed her rather fabulous nails, which she has painted red and gold and with a lucky cat. And so I am so excited because something immediately triggers in my mind. My brain is like off on fireworks because I always had this idea that societies face what I call the honor income trade-off. So in some parts of the world, men's honor depends on female seclusion. And even if there are more economic opportunities, because male honor is so important, because men fear the shame and stigma of letting your wife go and work and mix and mingle with other men, that they may forego all those economic opportunities. And women stay at home and you have these ideas of obedience. But in some countries, if female earnings increase, if you have economic growth, then women go off to work. And that could be part of East Asia's success, that it was just growth, that as female earnings rose, women went off to work. But now I realize something else. Actually, perhaps across the entire world, there could be cultural variation in how much people care about money, how much people value economic prosperity. You know, in some parts of the world, people could really value upward mobility, status in this life, economic prosperity. Whereas in other cultures, people might care more about the afterlife and getting to paradise or your family or community. You know, we're not all these, you know, materialists. And so then that night, I get very excited and I start reading more about Chinese cultures of abundance and wealth and prosperity. So now we need to understand the deep roots of this East Asian culture and reverence for meritocracy and upward mobility. So Confucius, you know, the famous Chinese philosopher, Confucius has a really bad reputation. So when Western political scientists or sociologists talk about him, they talk about hierarchy, authoritarianism, obedience, and patriarchy. And that's all true. But I think many people have overlooked and failed to recognize a very unique aspect that was idealized by Confucius and then entrenched and institutionalized by imperial dynasties. And people fail to realize this because very few people do in-depth qualitative research. So an East Asian scholar would just realize all this stuff, see all this stuff about money, but think that's normal, not realize that South Asia or the Middle East are so enormously different. But because I'm this little vagabond going all around the world, you know, traveling all these different places, you know, last year I spent a month in Morocco, 2 months in India, a month in Turkey. Because I do so much comparative research, I'm able to see these very glaring differences. So Confucius thought the rulers were better than the ruled. He supported a hierarchy, but he also supported meritocracy. He thought that any man who was virtuous, who was knowledgeable, who was skilled in these Confucian texts could rise up to become a ruler. And then in the 7th century, Empress Wu Zetian actually institutionalized meritocracy by making the Chinese civil service exams, the Keijiu examinations, open to all Chinese men. And this was based on Confucianism. And that spread with printing. Books became more accessible. So now, as a way of gaining social mobility, you had all these people all across China studying these Confucian books because in their hope, their great hope, that they could gain social mobility and gain these very honorable, prestigious positions as provincial rulers, governors, officials. And there are all these stories. So you get these stories of peasants or tradespeople rising up to become the great literati. And the literati, the officials, are really revered. So these ideas of upward mobility, status in this life, and this being open to all is very distinct. And there is even this wonderful research showing that in the period of Empress Wu Zetian, in the Tang Dynasty, Ding Dynasty, tomb epitaphs show that you had this rise in meritocracy, that it wasn't just about the aristocrats keeping and consolidating all the privileges for themselves. Now, knowing your Confucian text becomes very, very important. And then when the Joseon dynasty in Korea also adopted Confucianism, these Confucian ideals spread across East Asia. So what this means, therefore, is that everyone adopts this idea of, you know, achieving status in this life, of seeking economic prosperity. And, you know, under the imperial dynasties, you know, traders and market people were not seen in high status. But when you had the transition, when markets and trade opened up in the 20th century, then people really seized those opportunities for economic mobility. And, you know, one of the reasons why East Asia got rich was because you had high skills at low wages. And skills were high because people revered education. Parents invested enormous sums in education because they really, really believed in education. And they believed in upward mobility. So another way in which I saw this desire for economic prosperity is that I went to Hong Kong's Lunar New Year Festival. And in many ways, it was just like a German traditional Christmas fair with, you know, toys and fun things to eat. And I bought myself, you know, spicy lobster on a stick or whatever. But there were so many images of money. There were, you know, all these red packets, which are traditional gifts of money. There were all these, you know, wishes for getting rich, or we wish you wealth. You know, a common Cantonese and Mandarin saying for New Year is, may you get rich. And then I pop into the supermarket and the supermarket freezer, as you mentioned, is a dragon saying, get rich. So everywhere is all red and gold, get rich, get rich. So all the children, both young men and young women, are getting this message that the greatest thing you can achieve is money and wealth. Now, on the one hand, some people might be a little bit squeamish and they think, oh, you know, materialism, that's very, you know, that's a very narrow view of human flourishing. And I'm not a philosopher or a moralist. And certainly, you know, you can see the downsides of materialism because it's a very single metric of success. And it means that, especially for young men, there's enormous pressure to thrive, enormous pressure in education, enormous pressure for status. And that can be associated with perhaps depression or very, you know, risk of anxiety. So I'm not saying that materialism or economic prosperity should be supported as values, but you can see it's had enormous effect on culture. It's because East Asians really valued economic prosperity that they sent their daughters to the factories. They sent their daughters to the factories because they wanted to prosper. Whereas in South Asia or the Middle East or North Africa, you know, people may value money, of course, people might want to be wealthier, but it may not be their overriding desire. So for example, in Mumbai, I was interviewing a Muslim trader. And after he went to Saudi Arabia, his wife started wearing the hijab and she certainly doesn't leave the flat. And he was telling me that during COVID, one of his co-workers at the market, his wife went started earning money because they were deeply indebted. And he actually told that friend, listen, my friend, this is not good. You know, yeah, the most important thing is to get paradise.
So this is the honor thing. The most important thing is the honor thing.
Yeah. And he said to his friend, listen, our time on earth is just a testing ground. Our time on earth is just a drop in the ocean. What ultimately matters is getting to paradise. And you get to paradise by women separating themselves from unrelated men, and so not going into the workforce. So in India, the rate of female labor force participation is 20%. And in places like Rajasthan, only 12% of women in urban areas work. In Bihar, where I was, you know, I was in four villages in Bihar, and the labor force participation is only 5%. And I said to the women there, have any women ever left this village for work? And they said, no. So men go maybe to Patna or Calcutta for work, but it is too shameful to let your wife come to work. So men just migrate independently. So all the migration for work is mostly male. And then I went to Uzbekistan for a month. I was based in 10 different villages and towns across Uzbekistan. I had 10 different research assistants helping me out so I could get to their trusted networks. And in one city, Namangan, I went to the market and I was the only woman in that entire market. I did not see a single other woman. And I chatted to some of the men there. And, you know, I said to these guys, you know, how do you feel about women working? And I said to one guy, okay, suppose your wife was a really, really persuasive, charismatic trader. Suppose she could get a revenue that was four times yours. And he was like, listen, even if she could earn 10 times me, I still wouldn't want her to work. And so that is the honor income trade-off, that some people really value honor over income. And now you may say, oh, Alice, that's just an anecdote. What do you know? So there's this wonderful new economics paper by Suhani Jalhotra and Lisa Ho, and they do a randomized controlled trial in Mumbai. And so they give one tranche of women the option of working in a female office. So it's like about 5 minutes walk from their home. They're going to get $150 a month. They're very poor slum dwellers. Do they take the job? About 60% of them do, but the next day they speak to their husbands and only about 20% of them do. And that's in line with Indians' rates of female labor force participation. And whether or not the woman has children makes no difference as to whether she accepts the job. The massive binding constraint is that men's honor depends on female seclusion, and men worry about stigma and rumor and gossip and losing their place, losing their status. If you really care about honor and you worry that other men are going to judge you or think that you're less of a man, unable to provide for your wife, then you just don't take those economic opportunities. And even when they gave offered women $300 a month, which is a lot of money for slum-dwelling people,
they didn't take it.
Most of them still said no. So that really is the honor income trade-off. That in a society which really values male honor, it's like economic prosperity isn't the most important thing. It's not the overriding preference.
So let's just go back to the Chinese, and then I want to end in Ireland. Okay, it's a little bit of a jump, but here we go. Right. So what you're saying is what you saw in China, what you saw was this embracing of materialism. You know, al fresco. Flamboyant, outward, unashamed materialism. Have good things, have new things, have nice things. This in its of itself is something to be yearned and something to be strived for. And that in a way explains in your head a lot of what's going on, you think, in China at the moment.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So although Chinese people do believe in honoring their ancestors, you honor your ancestors through success in this life. It's all about achieving success in this life. You know, the paradise thing is less important. So the more that you value economic prosperity, the more that women strive for that.
So just finally, Alice, right, today is International Women's Day. You've mentioned this honor income trade-off. I think certainly older Irish listeners are listeners who talk to their parents or their grandparents. Their grandparents will really identify what you're talking about. They will understand this. So we came from a society that was sort of unmoored from Western Europe for about 100 years for a variety of cultural and colonial and historic reasons, all that good stuff we're not going to go into. But unmoored in the sense that after the Second World War, where women in Belgium, women in France, women in Italy, women in Germany, clearly Scandinavia, and of course in Britain, were progressing forward, going into the workforce, Irish women were not, because explicitly the Catholic Church had ruled, which was very much an honor institution. And yet, in my lifetime, women have not only ascended economically, but educationally. You can see this from falling birth rates. You can see this from a variety of reasons. How does a country, when you look at the progression of Ireland, and then you talk about your time in Uzbekistan, and you talk about your time in India, is it a foregone conclusion that society will evolve in the way that our societies have evolved in? Or do you think that is a kind of patronizing Western view of the world?
Great question, right? Should we be Whiggish and think that everyone is going to become more gender equal? It's just a matter of time. No.
You've got to find your inner Edmund Burke. You see, this is what we're going to find, right? You know, Edmund Burke, the great Irish philosopher, right? So is it all going to go that way?
No, I don't believe so. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that. So, in, for example, Sri Lanka has prospered economically, but female employment is as low as Pakistan. In the Middle East, North Africa, South Asia, there are very strong ideals of female obedience and very low female employment. You know, Ireland broke out of that honor-income trade-off because people increasingly became more secular, even though the Catholic Church was a major landholder and did have very strong ties to government, which, you know, tried to repress that secularization. It has nevertheless secularized. And alongside that, we see cultural liberalization, alongside massive push for same-sex marriage and also abortion rights. So Ireland has secularized. Spain has undergone the exact same transition post-Franco. Massive cultural liberalization. 48% of Spanish people now identify as feminists. Latin America has also seen that massive transition. You know, there's been soaring female employment, feminist activism against male violence, and massive female representation. 11 legislative assemblies in Latin America now have gender parity. In Mexico, and right now, you've got 2 female presidential candidates. So these Catholic countries, many of them are converging, definitely, becoming much more gender equal. But you don't see that in the Middle East and South Asia. That's the gender divergence.
Alice Evans, this has been an amazing tour de force. Really has an amazing tour de force. I can't think of a better way for the podcast to talk about International Women's Day. But what sticks in my mind, though, is the red nails of the elderly Cantonese lady signifying you should get rich. I mean, that's proper for me. That's absolutely proper. I hope you enjoyed your first trip on the Dave McWilliams podcast.
Oh, it was a treat, a pleasure, an honour.
Alice, that is wonderful. We will talk to you again very, very shortly.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
That was really good. That was really fascinating stuff. And actually, you know, there's a couple of points I'd love to kind of discuss a bit further on what Alice was saying there. But two things straight off is, you know, the difference in cultures and how religion plays a huge part in each of those cultures.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of battle between this life and the afterlife, the get rich now kind of materialism compared to the live humbly and honorably now for the spiritual afterlife. I thought that was fascinating. But the other thing as well is, and it's something that we spoke about before in a different kind of guise, was the whole idea of meritocracy.
Well, I think what is really fascinating about what Alice said is anything that if you've ever been to China, particularly Hong Kong, Chinese people love money, right? Now, this is something, and it's sometimes, you know, in the West, there's a lot of like poo-pooing about, oh, you can't possibly say this. That, you know, Chinese people love material advances, right? Years and years ago, I worked as a waiter. Can you imagine this, John? As actually a bartender in a Chinese restaurant in Spadina Avenue in Toronto. And my boss was a fella called J.D. Lee, right? From Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And I had never come across such materialist people in my life. They had all the kit, they had all the cars, their kids were dressed up in all the brands. It was hilarious. Like basically what they were saying is, I'm making good money, I'm making good cash, and I'm going to show everybody, right? And of course, we come from, ironically, the Irish tradition, which is you don't show anything.
Yeah, quiet money, modest money.
We also come from the Christian tradition, if you think about it, that the meek will inherit the earth, right? So this goes back to your idea of culture, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, if you think about those Christian ideas, those seminal Christian notions, which is that to be rich is actually to be wrong. And if you are rich in this world, you will not get salvation in the next world. And if you were a rich man, you're going to find it very hard to get into heaven, so hard that it'll be easier for the camel to get through the eye of the needle than the rich man to get to heaven.
Yeah.
So we're brought up in all this sort of culture. I end up in Spadina Avenue in Toronto witnessing the other culture, which was the Chinese sort of, I'm going to make a few quid here, right? And I'm going to show everybody. And money is good, and money and wealth and hope. And then that all the whole Confucian idea of luck being a huge part and fortune and good fortune and all that stuff. So what I find is fascinating because lots and lots of people say, why is East Asia growing so quickly, right? And all economists say, well, it's about total factor productivity and it's about policies and it's about this. Maybe it's down to the fact that these people love brass, right? And they work hard for brass. And in order then to show that they have the money, they consume in a way in which maybe Westerners don't. So I love that. I mean, it's also, it can be regarded as extremely, you know, racially stereotyping and all that for dangerous stuff. But it is really, it's a fascinating. And what she's saying is then, because of the love of material wealth, the Chinese have had a much, much, much smaller barrier to women going into the workforce because that trade-off between honor and income is skewed towards income. So the huge resource that is Chinese women has been deployed into the economy to generate income over and above what you were talking about, other societies like India, where they're still obsessed with honor.
Yeah, that was an interesting point about how the difference in culture and attitudes towards gender has such an impact on economics and the economy.
Yeah. Now, again, what you find is that female gender equality, as evidenced in China, propels the economy, and the economy propels female gender equality. So the two of them are mutually reinforcing. And what you have in India, which of course is the next big story in the global economy, is still this sort of tradition which is subjugating women. And as Alice was talking about, women from the slums in Mumbai not going to work even when the work is available because they go back and their men think, oh my God, this is bringing shame on the family and shame on me and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and only 20% of them work.
It's amazing. So the question then is, and I think even her statistics is even less in certain areas. So the amazing question on International Women's Day for the theme of this podcast, John, is whether or not we will see over the next 20 or 30 years a similar trajectory as we've seen in East Asia, where young girls do very well in school, young girls do very, very well in the labor market, young girls, therefore, don't necessarily have to go out and get married early. And as you can see, then the demographic implication of that is the population begins to fall, which is precisely why the Chinese at the very top of the program are trying to promote fertility, simply because fertility falls as women become economically much more well off because they have a choice. They don't have to become, you know.
Yes.
So it's a fascinating area. And I think we should come back to, John, what you put your finger on there, which is the role of tradition and religion and culture in economics, right? Because economics tends to try to pretend, John, that it is colorblind, that it is neutral on culture, that is neutral on religion, and that we can discuss the economy without discussing deep culture. And frankly, and a message for us is, we can't. So I think happy International Women's Day, celebrating all our sisters, our mothers, our daughters, our wives, our girlfriends, our best mates, all that good stuff. And we talk to you on Tuesday.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.